All right, open your Bibles to the book of Daniel, chapter 10. We are going to finish our study in Daniel tonight, covering chapters 10 through 12. I hope that as we've gone through this book, that we've come away with a sense of just how great this book is, and more importantly, how great our God is. The songs that Robert led tonight really were fitting to open up this sermon tonight. God rules the world. That's what the theme of Daniel is, that you know, when things don't seem to make sense to us, whenever we're being persecuted, when we're in exile as Daniel and the Israelites were, and God is still in control. God rules the world in every facet of that. Tonight we're going to cover 10 through 12, and that's three chapters. So this is one vision. And it's going to be a quick lesson tonight, meaning we're going to be moving rapidly, trying to cover that. I mentioned at the end of last week's lesson, at the end of Daniel 9, there's a short vision of the 70 weeks. And I mentioned that that's the most difficult part of the book of Daniel. And I said I meant that when I said it, but I have to change my mind about that after studying for this lesson tonight. So this vision, I think, is very difficult for a couple of reasons. First of all, because the history that it deals with, we're just unfamiliar with. It deals with the history between the Testaments, the time period of the Maccabees, the 400 years of silence. Sometimes we teach our kids, and that's one of the periods of Bible history. We just don't know much about that. We're unfamiliar with that time period. Secondly, especially towards the end of chapter 11, getting into chapter 12, it's really difficult to unravel what that passage is talking about. There's a diversity of opinions about that, even among our brethren. And so the point tonight is not to get every single detail memorized of this vision. We're not going to be able to do that. If we were doing this in a class period, maybe we would try to slow down and try to soak in more of the details here. But what I want to do tonight, moving rapidly, is just to help us get a big picture of what this last vision is all about. There are some really encouraging lessons that come from this vision. What Daniel is doing, what this book does for the exiles and for those that would come after the exile, is it prepares them for what's going to come in their future. So there would be this time period, about 400 years, after the book of Malachi, where God would not reveal anything, God would not speak to any prophet, he wouldn't write any scripture for 400 years. And yet the Jews were going through this intense time of persecution. So living as a Jew in that time period, you would start to wonder, has God completely abandoned us? And the point here in the book of Daniel, especially at the end, is a reminder that God is in control even when God is silent. And God is still there. God is still working ultimately to bring about your redemption through the Messiah. So this vision prepares God's people for what's to come in that period of silence leading up to, and we've talked about this, leading up to the establishment of God's kingdom. And that's really what this book really looks forward to. So let's just jump into chapter 10 and let's read verse 1. Chapter 10 is the introduction to the vision. Chapters 11 and 12 are the vision itself and the explanation, some explanation to this vision. Verse 1, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel, who was named Belteshazzar. And the message was true and one of great conflict. But he understood the message and had an understanding of the vision. A little bit of irony here at the beginning where it says that Daniel understood the vision. But later on, it says that he doesn't understand. This is a very difficult vision to understand, and it's very difficult for us, especially. But you notice in verse 1, it says, this is taking place in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. This is the last date that's given in the book of Daniel. The first date that was given is in chapter 1, verse 1, 605 BC, whenever Babylon comes, Nebuchadnezzar comes and takes Judah into captivity. This is the last date, 537 BC. Daniel has been there the whole time. From 605 BC to 537, if I've done my math right, that's 68 years. That's a long time for Daniel to live. It's a long time for Daniel to be faithful to God. But Daniel has been there the whole time. Verse 1 also tells us that this message was true and one of great conflict. That's exactly what we're going to see, is that this message, this vision, it really is about the bloodshed, the wars, the battles that would take place, and Israel would be right in the middle of it. Verse 2, in those days I, Daniel, had been mourning for 3 entire weeks. I did not eat any tasty food, nor did any meat or wine enter my mouth, nor did I use any ointment at all until the entire 3 weeks were completed. So Daniel is fasting, a period of mourning, perhaps foreseeing the previous visions of difficulty and persecution. On the 24th day of the first month, while I was by the bank of the great river, that is the Tigris, I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, there was a certain man dressed in linen, whose waist was girded with a belt of pure gold of Uphaz. His body was like beryl. His face had the appearance of lightning. His eyes were like flaming torches. His arms and feet like the gleam of polished bronze. And the sound of his words like the sound of a tumult. Now, who is this man that we're seeing here? The text doesn't tell us, specifically identify him. Some have suggested, based upon a comparison to Revelation 1, that this is the Christ, this is Messiah that's seen before the cross. Others have suggested this is simply an angel. If it is an angel, then I believe this is the most vivid description of an angel in the entire Bible. But what we need to realize is that this appearance, whoever this individual is, he's in the presence of greatness here. Daniel is. In verse 7, now I, Daniel, alone saw the vision, while the men who were with me did not see the vision. Nevertheless, great dread fell on them, and they ran and hid themselves. So I was left alone and saw this great vision, yet no strength was left in me, for my natural color turned to a deathly pallor, and I retained no strength. But I heard the sound of his words, and as soon as I heard the sound of his words, I fell into a deep sleep on my face, with my face to the ground. Daniel, if this is just an angel, notice Daniel is in the presence of a heavenly being here. And he responds with dread, with fear. You know, we need to understand, when we study this book, we need to come away with an understanding of just how great God is. To stand in his presence, to stand even in the presence of one of his heavenly angels, is an incredible thing. Daniel is so enthralled and so terrified by this that it says that he falls into a deep sleep. It's almost like he passes out. He's so afraid of what he's seeing here. He is overwhelmed by what he's seeing. Verse 10, then behold, a hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees. He said to me, O Daniel, man of high esteem, understand the words that I'm about to tell you and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you. And when he had spoken this word to me, I stood up trembling. Then he said to me, do not be afraid, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart on understanding this and on humbling yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come in response to your words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia was withstanding me for 21 days. Then behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I had been left there with the kings of Persia. Now I have come to give you an understanding of what will happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision pertains to the days yet future. Now I want to stop right there for just a couple of minutes. In verse 14, I think is a key to understanding what's to come in this vision. This angel, or this heavenly being says that this vision is going to be about what's going to happen to Daniel's people in the latter days, or in the days of the end. Now the question is, what is the days of the end? Is that the end of time that is still future for us, you know, the second return, or the return of Christ? Or is this something else? Well, if you go back to chapter 8, in chapter 8, we didn't spend a whole lot of time in chapter 8, but this was the vision of the ram with the two horns and the shaggy goat that was budding it and destroying it and magnifying itself, specifically identified as the Medo-Persian Empire and then the Grecian Empire. In verse 17, the angel that is talking to Daniel says, son of man, understand that the vision pertains to the time of the end. Now, it's specifically said that this is about those two empires that are to come. Now, we know that that's not the end of time, but he uses that to refer to those two empires. And so we come to chapter 10. Really, what we are seeing in chapter 10 is a parallel vision to chapter 8. It's much about the Persian Empire and the coming Greek Empire, and even some future into that. The end here is not the end of time, as we would say, but it's really the end of God's use of Israel as his covenant people before ushering in the time of the Messiah. What God is telling his people is your time is coming to an end. God has used Israel, but their time as his covenant people is coming to an end. Then they're going to look forward to something even greater to come. So this book, this vision, prepares Israel for persecution we're going to see, but also for the Messiah and what he is going to do. Five more times in this vision, we're going to see that this vision is about the end. Boy, I really need to speed up in order to get to the end here. All right, so what's interesting about this passage, though, drop on down to verse 20. Then he said, "Do you understand why I came to you? But I have, but I shall now return to fight against the prince of Persia. So I am going forth, and behold, the prince of Greece is about to come. However, I will tell you what is inscribed in the writing of truth. Yet there is no one who stands firmly with me against these forces except Michael, your prince." So this angelic being specifically identifies the Persian kings or the Persian princes and the Grecian empires that is to come. So this vision is going to deal with that empire we're going to see. But what's really fascinating about this chapter is that what you see is God is pulling back the curtain, and you see the angelic beings talking about a battle that's taking place in heaven. It says, "I was withstanding the princes, the kings of Persia up in heaven." What's he talking about there? You know, we don't see what's going on in the spiritual realm, but I think the Bible tells us that there is a spiritual realm that's really there. It's just as real as what we see here, but there's a battle taking place there. There's this grand battle between God and Satan. You see that even in the book of Revelation. So I had Troy read for us Ephesians chapter 6, where we are told to be strong in the Lord and the strength of his might. For our battle is not against fleshly battle. It's not a fleshly battle, but it's a spiritual battle waged against the powers, the principalities, the spiritual forces of darkness. What are those? Those are Satan and his minions, basically. I believe that we are in the midst of that battle. We may not see it, but it's there. And every conflict that we have against Satan is because of that conflict. But what you see here is you see God pulling back the curtain to show that the angels are fighting for us. The angels are on our side. They're protecting us. They're there to withstand the evil. Evil is going to seem like it has the upper hand sometimes, but God is still there waging war through his angels on our behalf. Chapter 11 really begins the vision. Verse 1, "In the first year of Darius the Mede, I arose to be an encouragement and a protection to him." This is still this angelic being talking. "And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia. Then a fourth will gain far more riches than all of them. As soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. And a mighty king will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. But as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor according to his own authority which he wielded, for his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others besides them." So we mentioned that this is a vision of conflict. What we see are five conflicts that the Israelites are prepared for. And the first is the one between Persia and Greece. We've already been clued in onto this in previous visions, how the Persians are going to be overrun by Greece. But verse 2 says that there are three more kings going to arise in Persia, and then a fourth is going to come that's going to supersede all of them. These kings would be Cambyses II, Smerdis, Darius, and Xerxes. Xerxes is the Ahasuerus that's mentioned in the book of Esther, by the way. Now, these aren't the only kings of Persia. There would be a total of nine Persian kings. But what you see in verse in verse 3 is a leap of about 130 years when a mighty king will arise and rule with great authority and do as he pleases. But as soon as he has arisen, he's going to be broken. And I think this specifically refers to Alexander the Great's rise and demise. What's remarkable about Alexander the Great is he came to power as a very young man. I think he was in his early 20s. And he died very shortly thereafter at the ripe old age of about 32. But only after he had circled all the way from Turkey and Greece all the way to India, the border of India, and conquered that territory. But you notice that this is a very similar vision to what we've seen in chapter 8 about this shaggy goat with this one horn. In chapter 8, verse 21, it says, "The shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king, the broken horn, and the four horns that arose in his place represent the four kingdoms which will arise from his nation, although not with his power." Same exact kind of language we see in chapter 11. His kingdom was broken, and it was divided up between four parts. History tells us that his successors were his generals. Over time, eventually, four generals took his place and broke up the empire. Namely, I'm not going to be able to pronounce the first one. Second one is Cassander, Seleucus the first of Nicator, and Ptolemy first Soter. The last two are the ones that are specifically significant to Bible history, because we're going to move right into the second conflict we see. Beginning in verse 5, we see the outcome of that division of Alexander the Great's empire. The Ptolemies and the Seleucids were a development, though the descendants of those generals would eventually come to power. And chapter 11, verses 5 through 20, talks about the specifics of that. What we're going to see in this vision, we're not going to read every single verse of this. We're not going to belabor it too much, but we're going to see incredible amount of detail what God is telling Daniel is going to happen. The most detailed vision ever in the Old Testament. So the Ptolemies, and I'm not sure why it begins with a P, but we pronounce it with a T. The Ptolemies would reign in Egypt down here. And the Seleucids would reign up in Syria. Now what's going to happen is they're going to be vying for power. Who's going to be the greater kingdom? And who's smack dab in the middle of that? But Israel, right? The people of God. And so this is going to be a hot area for a battleground between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Who's going to control Palestine? That's really the question. Israel's going to be smack dab in the middle of that. And they're going to, result of that is going to be intense persecution. For the first about 200 years, or excuse me, 100 years, the Ptolemies are going to have the upper hand. In verse 5, we read about the king of the south. The king of the south represents the kings of the Ptolemies. In verse 5, it says, "The king of the south will grow strong, along with one of his princes who will gain ascendancy over him and obtain dominion. His domain will be a great dominion indeed." Now, this first general, Ptolemy the first Soter, grew strong, but his general, Seleucus the first, also grew strong. He fled to Ptolemy, but then eventually he established his own kingdom in Syria later on. This is exactly what it's being referred to. And as we're going through this, you need to understand something. That as I was reading, I was just amazed at how much agreement there is on these details. From verse 1 of chapter 11 to about verse 35, everybody agrees what's being discussed here. Everybody agrees. It doesn't matter if you believe that the Bible is inspired or not. Even liberal critical scholars believe that this is talking about this time period. There's nothing really controversial here. The question really is when was this written? We'll come to that in just a minute. In verse 6, it says, "After some years, they will form an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south will come to the king of the north to carry out a peaceful arrangement, but she will not retain her position of power, nor will she remain with his power." So history tells us that Ptolemy II formed a marriage alliance between his daughter and the son of Antiochus II, Theos, who was reigning in Seleucia. Antiochus divorced his first wife, Laodice, and in order to marry the daughter of Ptolemy. But Laodice did not like that, so she eventually poisoned the king and her the wife who took her place and her child. And so this is what this text is talking about, how this arrangement did not work out in their favor. And I'm not going to belabor this a whole lot, but you get the point that this is a very specific prophecy that's talking about history that takes place. Up until about verse 15, the Ptolemies have the upper hand. Verse 15 is when the table turns. In verse 15, the Seleucids, the king of the north, begins to take the upper hand. In verse 15, we're going to drop down. Then the king of the north will come, cast up a siege ramp, and capture a well-fortified city, and the forces of the south will not stand their ground, not even the choicest troops, for there will be no strength to take a stand. This would take place under a little bit later, under Antiochus the Great. He would gain the upper hand in 198 AD when he took this fortified city of Sidon in that year. And the Ptolemies were pretty patient and very tolerant of the Israelites. They let them have their own religion and that sort of thing. They didn't persecute them a whole lot, but things change at this point. Notice verse 16. But he who comes against him will do as he pleases, and no one will be able to withstand him. He will also stay for a time in the beautiful land, that's referring to Palestine, with destruction in his hand. So the king of the north is going to come, Antiochus the Great, and he's going to come and he's going to start persecuting the Jews. Verse 17, he will set his face to come with the power of his whole kingdom, bringing with him a proposal of peace, which he will put into effect. He will also give him the daughter of women to ruin it, but she will not take a stand for him or be on his side. Here's another marriage alliance that does not go well. Antiochus the Great attempts a marriage alliance between his daughter Cleopatra, it's not the Cleopatra, but a Cleopatra, and the boy King Ptolemy V, reigning down in Egypt, but it turned out against him. And so what she ended up doing, the daughter ended up siding with her husband more than she did with her father. If there's a lesson to be learned from that, is that if you got a family feud, don't try to resolve it by marrying your kids. It doesn't go well. At least it did not go well in this period of history. But again, you see the detail and the prophecy here. In verse 18, then he will turn his face to the coastlands and capture many, but a commander will put a stop to his scorn against him. Moreover, he will repay him for his scorn. So Antiochus the Great is going to start advancing in Asia Minor to expand his territory, but Rome is going to come and send a couple of commanders and put an end to it. We don't want you here. You know, you're treading on our territory. So he's embarrassed. He goes back to his land, and he's a heavy tax is imposed on him, and one of his sons, Antiochus Epiphanes, is taken captive or as a hostage to Rome. Now, let's pause here for just a second. What do we do with the detail in this prophecy? As I mentioned earlier, critics attack it as if it was written after the fact. So it's easy for someone to say, well, it was just all written after it already happened, so that's why it's so detailed. But for us who believe in God, who speaks the end before the beginning, there's not a problem for us. I think this passage, looking at the detail of it, is so encouraging when we think about the inspiration of Scripture. If it was written by Daniel before all of this happened, a couple of hundred years before it happened, how did Daniel know this? Because God was telling him that. So it's not a problem for us who believe in God. That's really where the issue is. Do you believe in a God who can foretell things? That's really the issue. He knows the end from the beginning. Now, here's the third conflict. In verse 21, we see this man that's brought up, this despicable person, Antiochus Epiphanes. This is the son that was taken hostage to Rome, but he comes back and he takes over the kingdom. Verse 21, in his place, a despicable person will arise. Now, Scripture often does not comment on people's character, historical figures' character, but here it says, this guy is despicable. And he truly was. We're going to see why in just a minute. On whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred, But he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue. This individual is really the primary focus of this vision, because here things really begin to get tough on the Israelites. It's here that they are going to reach a really breaking point in their faith. They're going to reach some really difficult trouble. Drop on down to verse 29. Verse 29, still talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. And reminder, everyone agrees that this is who's being discussed. At the appointed time, he will return and come into the south, but this last time, it will not turn out the way it did before. For ships of Kittim will come against him. Therefore, he will become disheartened and will return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant and take action. So what happens here is Antiochus Epiphanes goes down to Egypt to fight the Ptolemies, but it does not go well. Rome comes, and they don't like him advancing his territory. They come across the Mediterranean Sea with ships, and they put a stop to that. There's a commander that specifically confronts Antiochus Epiphanes and says, "You decide if you're going to fight us or go back home." And Antiochus Epiphanes says, "Well, can it give me time to think about it?" And he says, "Yeah, you take all the time in the world." But he takes a stick and he draws a circle around him and he says, "You have all the time in the world, but you have to make up your mind before you leave that circle." And so he's embarrassed. He can't fight the Romans and the Egyptians at the same time. So he goes back home, but he's embarrassed, and it says that he's enraged. And he takes his anger out on the Israelites, on the Jews. It says that he comes back and he shows regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Verse 31, "Forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, and do away with the regular sacrifice. And they will set up the abomination of desolation." In 167 BC, Antiochus Epiphanes came and took out his anger on the Jews by sacrificing a pig. And we all know how the Israelites felt about pigs, by God's decree. We talked about that this morning. Unclean, despicable. He sacrifices a pig there. He sprinkles the whole area with pig broth and demands that they sacrifice on the 25th of every month, the monthly anniversary of his birthday. I mean, this guy is mad, and he just wants people to suffer for it, because that's the kind of person he was. He knows that the Jews feel strongly and are not allowed to touch a pig, and so he is taking his anger out on them. And the Jews are left with a choice. How are they going to respond? In verse 32, "By smooth words he will turn to godlessness, those who act wickedly toward the covenant. But the people who know their God will display strength and take action." So some of the Jews are going to say, "Okay, you know what? Antiochus is in power. I'm going to go with him." That's the way things are. When someone comes in power and things get hard, people tend to side with those in power because they don't want to suffer. But God says that people who know their God will display strength and take action. And you can read some of the books that are not in the Bible, the book of Maccabees, some of the apocryphal books that tell us some of the history and the stories of courage during this time of people who rose up and fought against this and tried to restore the temple, because this is a persecution of God's people. In verse 33, "Those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many, yet they will fall by sword and by flame, by captivity and by plunder for many days." Notice that in verse 33, some are going to fall by flame. Now, earlier in the book of Daniel, we read about how Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were thrown into the fire but did not die by flame. They were delivered. But there's going to be a time when God's people are not going to be delivered by flame. This is going to be a test for them. In verse 34, "Now when they fall, they will be granted a little help, and many will join with them in hypocrisy. Some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time." One of the lessons we take from this time period and this text is that persecution is going to have an end result in one of two ways. It's going to have two effects. It's going to either harden us, or it's going to refine us. It's going to test our loyalty. And that's what Jesus teaches. If you love your father, your mother greater than me, you're not worthy to be my disciple. But those who carry the cross daily, those are worthy to be Jesus' disciples. It's going to test our loyalty. And so verse 36 is kind of a summary of the character of Antiochus Epiphanes. It says, then the king will do as he pleases, and he will exalt and magnify himself above every god, and will speak monstrous things against the God of gods, and he will prosper until the indignation is finished, for that which is decreed will be done. That describes his arrogance. He's going to exalt himself above every god, including the God. And by the way, the word Epiphanes means God manifest. That's a name that Antiochus chose for himself. That tells us something about his self-esteem, doesn't it? God manifest, God in the flesh. Now, the Jews didn't like to call him that. They called him Antiochus Epimenes, which meant Antiochus madman. But you can see his arrogance was extraordinary. And this is, again, which makes him despicable. And this is what we've seen in the book of Daniel. We've seen arrogant kings like Nebuchadnezzar, who looks at his kingdom and says, this is Babylon the Great that I have built. Look what I have done. He doesn't give a thought to what God has done for him. And same is true here. God is really the great king here. It's not him. And so you see him persecuting God's people in his arrogance, and he's eventually going to fall. Now, it's at this point, around verse 36, maybe at verse 40, that the variety, the diversity of interpretations begin to come into place. I believe, and I can change on this based upon future studies, but I believe that verse 40 beginning there is discussing the Ptolemies and Rome, that this is future from Antiochus Epiphanes. There's another view that says this is still a continuation of description of Antiochus Epiphanes. There is a third view, which is very common in the world today, the premillennialist view. Basically, what they do about verse 40, or maybe even backing up to verse 36, they stop there and they say that God's prophetic time clock has stopped, and that verse 36 describes the Antichrist that's coming still in the future, thousands of years later. The problem with that is there's nothing in the text that indicates there's this huge, 3,000-year break to indicate that. And so there's a lot of other challenges with that as well. But I believe this is discussing Rome and the Ptolemies. And the reason for that is a couple of things. The history just does not match up if it is Antiochus Epiphanes. And also because Jesus is going to quote some passages later on that he applies to the Roman Empire and how they are going to destroy the temple itself. The king of the south in verse 40 is, I believe, Cleopatra, Mark Antony. Cleopatra will be the last descendant of the Ptolemies. And the king of the north here, I think, is Rome, who is going to conquer Palestine in about 64 BC. You see, in verse 40, at the end time, the king of the south will collide with him, and the king of the north will storm against him with chariots, with horsemen, and with many ships. And he will enter countries, overflow them, and pass through. And he will enter the beautiful land again. There's Palestine. And many countries will fall, but these will be rescued out of his hand, Edom, Moab, and the foremost of the sons of Ammon. He will stretch out his hand against other countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape. I think it's a description just of the expansion of the Roman Empire. Not going to make a huge deal about that. But then chapter 12. Chapter 12, I think, begins to describe the conflict, the last conflict between Rome and Israel. In verse 1, it says, now at the end of time, at that time, Michael the great prince who stands guard over the sons of your people will arise. Remember back in chapter 10, we talked about how this angelic being says, I was standing against the kings of Persia. Here he's coming back to that theme. Notice that the angel here, Michael, stands guard over the sons of your people. If you're in a time, if you're going through difficult times as a Christian, how encouraging is it to know that there is an angel that's standing and protecting us as God's people? I mean, that's what the text is telling us, that this is the angel that's standing guard over his people. And there will be a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And at that time, your people, everyone who is found written in the book, will be rescued. He's talking about this great distress that's going to come. great distress, such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. You go over to Matthew chapter 24, verse 21, when Jesus is foretelling the destruction of Jerusalem, and he says that there's going to be a distress that is never, as such as has never happened before. It's figurative language to tell us that this is intense and overwhelming persecution. But I would connect that with this. In verse 2, many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake, these to everlasting life, but the others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. This, I think, is a figurative resurrection. It's not talking about the final resurrection. You remember back in Ezekiel 37, the valley of dry bones? That passage is not about the final resurrection, but it's about the redemption of Israel, the reunification of Israel under one king that's specifically named as David. David had been dead long ago, but it's a messianic prophecy that tells about the redemption of Israel through the Messiah, Christ. And I think this is similar to that. A resurrection of the people of God, a restoration of the people of God through the Messiah. You see the victory of God's people in verse 3. Those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven, and those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. But as for you, Daniel, conceal these words and seal up the book until the end time. Many will go back and forth and knowledge will increase. He's told to seal this up because the application for this is going to be in the future. People are going to need it later on. So it's not to keep it secret, but to preserve this. In verse 5, then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, two others were standing, one on the bank of the river and the other on that bank of the river. And one said to the man dressed in linen, the one that we saw in chapter 10, who is above the waters of the river, how long will it be until the end of these wonders? I heard the man dressed in linen, who was above the waters of the river, as he raised his right hand and his left toward heaven, and swore by him, this is an unbreakable oath here, that it would be for a time, times, and half a time, and as soon as they finish shattering the power of the holy people, all these events will be completed. I think that's a key verse there. Power of God's people, the holy people, is going to be shattered. I think this is a reference to the destruction of Jerusalem. And this is when all these things are going to be completed. In verse 8, as for me, I heard but could not understand. So I said, my Lord, what will be the outcome of these events? And he said, go your way, Daniel, for these words are concealed and sealed up until the end time. Many will be purged, purified, and refined, but the wicked will act wickedly. And none of the wicked will understand, but those who have insight will understand. From the time that the regular sacrifice is abolished and the abomination of desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days. Now, the reason that I keep going back to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 is because Jesus quotes from this very passage in Matthew chapter 24, verse 15, when he says, when you see the abomination of desolation that set up in Jerusalem, which was written in Daniel, and in parentheses, Matthew includes, let the reader understand, I think that's a quotation directly here from Daniel chapter 12. And that's, of course, applying to the destruction of Jerusalem. So, big picture here. Daniel is getting a big picture of what's going to happen in the future of God's people. That from the time that they go back to Israel, the Palestine, the promised land, that there is going to be an empire that's going to come. The Grecian Empire that's going to arise, and from that it's going to be a great conflict and persecution, but things are just going to continue getting worse and worse until the Messiah comes. And then one day, even the temple itself will be destroyed. But you know what? It's going to be okay. Because it's not about the physical temple. It's about the real presence of God that comes down from heaven. The temple of Jesus' own body. In verse 12, here's the exhortation. How blessed is he who keeps waiting and attains to the 1,335 days. But as for you, go your way to the end, you Daniel, then you will enter into rest and rise again for your allotted portion at the end of the age. Now, those numbers, 1,290 and 1,335, don't know the exact significance of that. But I think the basic point there is that this period of persecution is going to be a long period, but your perseverance must outlast the persecution. Blessed is he who endures to the 1,335 days. You know, it's the point is that if you know that you're going to win the game, if you know that going into it, you're going to win the game no matter what, then why would you give up in the third quarter if you know at the end of the fourth quarter that you're going to have victory? And that's what God is encouraging Daniel with. And so this is a passage that encourages them to remain in the faith, to stick it out, to trust in the Lord. Let me just really quickly show you a summary of the book of Daniel as we bring this book to a close. So a summary of all of the visions so far. Chapter 2 is the statue vision. And we specifically identified, Daniel specifically identified the head of gold as being Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar himself. And the next empire that would arise is the arms and the chest of silver, the Medo-Persians. The Grecian Empire is the thighs of bronze. And then Rome is not specifically identified in the book, but historically they are the legs and the feet of iron and clay. In chapter 7, we saw this same vision in just different pictures. We saw the lion with the wings, referring to Babylon. We saw the bear that's raised up on one side with three ribs in its mouth that's devouring much meat, Medo-Persians. And the Grecian Empire described as this leopard with wings and four heads, and Rome being this monster beast we described, you know, greater and more terrifying than the others. We come to chapter 8, and here's where we get some specific identification of the Medo-Persians being described as the ram with the two horns, and then the shaggy goat that's, you know, feet aren't touching the ground because he's running so fast to destroy them, specifically being identified in chapter 8 as the Grecian Empire. In chapter 9, we saw that the 70-week vision, that from the time that Jerusalem would be rebuilt, or the time for the decree for the Jerusalem to be rebuilt, to the time of the abomination of desolation will be 70 weeks. After the 69th week, it said that the Messiah would be cut off and have nothing. That, I think, is referring to Christ. Then chapters 10 through 12, this final vision, beginning four kings of Persia will arise. The kings of the north and the south will persecute God's people, ultimately ending up with another abomination of desolation, with the destruction of the temple. All of that is wrapped up in chapters 10 through 12. That's a summary of the visions of the book of Daniel. What's the point? The point is that God's kingdom is going to stand forever and ever. That's what, that God is going to establish his kingdom, and that whatever happens in the future today, God's kingdom is going to stand forever and ever. I don't think we realize what a great blessing we have in the kingdom of God. We talk about it, we preach about it, we read about it, but we don't really appreciate the blessing we have in the kingdom of God. I want to conclude really quickly. In Luke chapter 2, we read about two interesting characters who see Jesus as an infant. Their names are Simeon and Anna. And Luke tells us that Simeon, in verse 25, was looking for the consolation of Israel. And Anna, when she holds Christ and she hears about him coming, she goes out of the temple and she begins to speak to him. Speak to all those who are looking for the redemption of Jerusalem. Simeon and Anna were waiting for something to happen. They were looking for the Christ. They were looking for the redemption of God's people. Why? Because they read the book of Daniel. Because they saw that the Messiah is coming after all of these things. They didn't know when, but they knew that it was coming. And the question is, what are we waiting for? What are we expecting? Are we looking forward? We're in the kingdom of God. If you're a Christian, you're in this kingdom that we've been talking about. But we're still waiting for something. We're waiting for the final consummation of that kingdom, where Jesus is going to come and we're going to be taken to him, and we're going to be in his kingdom forever and ever. Would you like to be a part of that kingdom and have that hope? We encourage you as we sing the song and as we stand and sing.